I start cruising through one of these hard drives that I work on, and I look at the volume of work that I've done, documents I've collected, briefs I've written, clients I've handled across the country, it blows me away that I stayed on the job to this degree for this long and have so little to show for it, except my understanding of government. That, yeah, I'll take that from this. It is invaluable. If you don't know where you stand, you don't know anything. So, I didn't waste the time when you look at it from that standpoint. Very, very important work that I've done. Standing on the shoulders of Kurt Riggin. Kurt Riggin created Louis Ewing. Kurt Riggin created me. And Louis Ewing has made his own progress and achievements, mostly in criminal procedure and let's see, also a lot of work on jurisdiction and legislative history. But he's wrong on a couple of things, and I'm invisible, so they're just out there saying I'm right and everybody else is wrong. They won't even look at my work to see that the law shifts the burden. There's a quote that I always use in tax briefs. A determination must be a consideration of all relevant facts and statutes. The presumption of correctness enjoyed by the commissioner disappears upon introduction of evidence to the contrary. Amen. And so you put evidence to the contrary on the record. In FDA versus Brown and Williamson, 2000, Supreme Court decision, the intrinsic evidence the Supreme Court said the tobacco company was using was statute. Statute was their intrinsic evidence. It was the heart of their challenge. So, evidence to the contrary. I have a law that says all property is a cost. Section 83. I got 5 Supreme Court cases that say any or any property is an all-inclusive term. How come you exclude labor from the value of any money or property paid? And they penalize you for asking. Oh, boy. And you've seen it work exactly that way. We've just done this for the last 4 years in court after court. So it's pretty obvious. I've proven it over and over and over again, and yet I'm invisible. This is a great case, Yakima versus Mollett. Hang on. It's going to be wevgov.com/all lowercase, no spaces. Well, let's see here. Mollett, Mollett, .doc. wevgov.com/Mollett. .doc. I'm going there to rename the file exactly that. Hang on just a second. Mollett. .doc. This is a very important case because it translates to state constitutions all over the place. where your state constitution says bail shall be available by sufficient sureties. But when you go into your courts, you'll see that in traffic court here and there, misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor court, maybe even in felony court, county superior court, you know, the judges will impose cash only bail. Well, the constitution for the state says bail shall be available by sufficient sureties. Where's your permission to exclude bonds? A bond is a surety. And they impose cash only bail. What were you thinking? So you want to read Mollett, Yakima versus Mollett. It's a great case from, I think, 2000, maybe. Let's see here. I'm going to open that. 2003, Yakima versus Mollett, Washington State appellate case. And they said it doesn't, they didn't say it violates the Constitution, because it was argued that it violates court rules too. And so they said, yeah, it violates court rules. Next case, please. They didn't want to have to reach the constitutional question. Why? Because they'd have to reverse probably in the neighborhood of 40,000 convictions, 50,000 convictions, because cash-only bail violates the court rule and the constitutional provision that says bail shall be available by sufficient sureties. You cannot exclude bonds. You don't have the permission. See how damning that could be? If they keep somebody in jail on cash-only bail, you make that challenge. You tell your attorney to go look up the briefs in that case and write a cash-only bail challenge. You know, when you raise your voice, the government clubs you with a baseball bat in the form of trips to jail needlessly. They've done it to me. They've done it to Kurt Riggin. Well, Kurt Riggin would go into jail without argument, and he'd write up a motion to dismiss a case for cash-only bail, and 20 people would walk out of jail because they all photocopy the motion, or copy the motion with pencils, whatever, and they all file this motion, and he emptied the jail a couple times. Kurt has style, man. He kicks really hard. Oh man, he represented a bunch of people in Colorado state courts. He lives down in Colorado, and one particular client was blind and had a red tip cane and glass eyeballs, and he was in the crosswalk crossing with the light. The light was in his favor, and he got struck by a car and landed on the car's windshield and broke the windshield. And he was cited criminally for vandalism by the cop that came to the intersection. And Kurt got that cop on the stand during the trial. And he says, tell me about your training. Okay, and the cop says, this many years, this many courses, I took a course on this and that. And Kurt says, now in your police report, it said you said Mr. Sullivan had a glassy stare, and so you knew he was on drugs. Tell me your training regarding being able to tell when somebody's on drugs. Well, I took this seminar for this many hours. I had this much time on such and such a squad where we busted drug, whatever, and I've done A, B, and C. And Kurt says, okay, do you know what this red cane means? This red-tipped cane? Yeah, it means he's blind. And you say here in your police report he had a glassy stare. Mr. Sullivan, can I borrow one of your eyes real quick? And Mr. Sullivan hands his eye to Kurt. And Kurt takes that glass eye over to the witness stand. And he puts it right in the cop's face. He says, is this the glassy stare? Is this the glassy stare you saw that? And he says, Mr. Sullivan, do you have more than one pair of eyes? Are both of your eyes made of glass? He says, yeah. Okay, so Kurt just destroyed the cop on the stand. Is this the glass? Like, you need an organ behind it with a minor chord for suspense. Is this the glassy stare? That's about the funniest thing I think I've ever heard of happening in a courtroom. Anyway, things you gotta know. I want to pick out another freebie since I've got you here. You'll like the Mollett case. When you read that and consider cash-only bail, compare it to your own state's constitution and see if they allow for cash-only bail. If it says bail shall be available by sufficient sureties, bingo. That's it. The next freebie I'll give you is the Portillo case. Portillo versus Commissioner of IRS, all lowercase, no spaces, wevgov.com/portillo.doc, P-O-R-T-I-L-L-O, P-O-R-T-I-L-L-O, portillo.doc. That's a tax case, obviously, where Portillo was a painter. And Navarro had a building he needed painted, and he hired Portillo. And when Navarro handed in a 1099 on Portillo, he grossly overstated how much the contract was for. And the IRS presumed the 1099 was accurate and went and cleaned house on Portillo. And Portillo got the judgment from the Fifth Circuit that says a determination is a consideration of all relevant facts and statutes. It's a great case about how they have to consider all relevant facts and statutes. So I always cite that one when I say, here's Section 83. You have to consider all statutes. A determination is a consideration of all relevant facts and statutes. So very important case. wevgov.com/Portillo.doc, P-O-R-T-I-L-L-O. That's right. It's in some of my very earliest research, 1991, when I was polishing off some of my findings, grabbing certain cases that just say, you know, this looks like the cat's meow. I'm looking through a very extensive folder here with tons of stuff. Let's see. Supreme Court cases. Oh boy. Oh boy. This one is 218 megabytes. I'm going to start uploading it right now. And it's going to take a while. I'm going to rename this file something very simple before I start to download it. It's 218 megabytes, and you're going to like it a lot. It's, let me see. It's a database of Supreme Court cases. And it's been a long time since I was in any of those files. Let's see, I can open this one. I'm opening the first PDF file in the, it's 1,047 pages. So each one of these PDF files in that folder are going to have tons of cases in each one of them. And I'm going to tell you how many, 57 PDF files, and each one of them are about 1,000 pages long. And it's going to be at wevgov.com/cases.zip. Cases.zip. All lowercase, no spaces. wevgov.com/cases.zip. It won't be ready to download for another 20 minutes. Okay? But I'm glad to give that to you. Mr. J. Lovett and Christopher J. Yeah. I'm working on a composition for... you're certainly welcome. I'm working on a composition to brief a particular aspect of abuse by the federal government, and that is... and by the press. Everybody blows it on this one. Oh, he threatened him. That was a threat. A threat against the president. A threat against the senator. A threat against the talk show host. A threat. Nobody knows what the hell a threat is under the law. They just throw that word around when they don't realize how dangerous it is. You don't throw a word like that around. You don't. Because if it's a real threat as the law defines it, they'll hold you in prison pending trial. You won't bail out. Well, they threaten the safety of the community if we were to allow them to remain free pending trial. They've threatened somebody, after all, Your Honor. And that person sits in prison until trial or until a plea agreement. Made a threat. Got to raid his house. What'd they find in your house? They found a pistol. Oh, it's legal. You own the pistol. But they found a joint. Did you know that a drug user with a gun is a federal criminal? 3 years in prison. For a drug user to possess a gun. Or a gun owner to possess a joint. 18 U.S.C. 922 G3. How's that for a wake-up call? 3 years in federal prison if you exercise your right to own a gun and smoke a joint. Wow! How many people in the state of Washington can you arrest under that law? So, you don't say threat. Because, man, the federal holes are deep. You'll be out of state prison in a month or two. The Fed's going to keep you for 18 to 24 months on that one. What else are they going to find in your house? I don't know you. I don't know what you have in your house. But think of how easy it is for them to get into your house by misinterpreting, maybe intentionally, your conduct. Thinking it's a threat. And they just throw that word out, get the arrest warrant, go to the judge, let's go. We're gonna bust them in their house and search it. It wasn't a threat. A threat is a very specific violation of law. Let's see. 879A3, I believe, is the statute that makes it a felony to threaten a presidential candidate or their family. Something like that. I can look that up quickly enough here. 18 U.S.C. 879. Threats against former presidents and certain federal and certain other persons. Threats against former presidents and certain other persons. 879A3. A major candidate for the office of president or vice president. Let's see here. It was Walter Bagdasarian on the Ninth Circuit. His conviction under 879A3 was overturned. I'm going to put the link in the chat here to the thingy at Cornell Law School, the link. 879A3, whoever knowingly and willfully threatens to kill, kidnap, or inflict bodily harm upon, 3, a major candidate for the office of president. Walter Bagdasarian put a bunch of stuff on a blog and was indicted and found guilty. He appealed it, and the Ninth Circuit overturned it because his conduct didn't meet the definition of a true threat. True threat is the threshold on the Ninth Circuit across the country, but I think I read a case on the Tenth Circuit that had a broader meaning of the term true threat than does the Ninth Circuit. That definition of threat is, I'm going to give you the whole site here. Like I said, I'm writing this up for the because the government abuses this statute. I thought I should check it out. There. There's the case law right there, beginning with U.S. versus Bagdasarian. For the purposes of federal criminal threat statutes, only true threats are punished. U.S. versus Sutcliffe. For the purposes of federal criminal threat statutes, a true threat is a threat to commit an act of unlawful violence against an individual or group of individuals, which must be conveyed or uttered in first-person context. I am going to do this to you. It cannot be, I am going to get other people to do this to you. That's called incitement. And incitement has not been punished. Pardon me. And here's another cite or a quote from U.S. versus Cassell, which is Ninth Circuit, 2004. And you'll see twice in there that they say it has to be an act to be carried out by the defendant. It has to be first person. Okay, it has to be first person. So when you, I just had an internet interruption I had to pause for, excuse me. It has to be in first person context. It cannot be incitement. So under this clearly established law, it's a circuit opinion, how to interpret the law, they don't punish incitement. So it would be legal for me to tell somebody, I'm going to talk other people into chopping your head off. That's legal. Because I didn't say, I'm going to chop your head off. Pretty simple. And this is, as I said, U.S. versus Cassell, C-A-S-S-E-L-L, 408 Federal 3rd, 622. 408 Federal 3rd, 622. Go to page 636. Start reading. So, first-person context has to be unlawful violence. And we have a law in Washington State and a bunch of other states that say you can use force to arrest a felon. If you have reasonable suspicion somebody has committed a felony, you can arrest them. Is that unlawful violence? No. And you're sure to tell them, don't struggle. I got bear spray. Or something else. It's what the cops always say. Don't struggle. You know, don't resist. No one to get hurt. Is that unlawful violence? No. It's lawful. It's a lawful use of force. Violence is illegal use of force. So under this framework, the true threat is not met by threatening to cause somebody else to do something. it's not a true threat to threaten to cause somebody else to do something legal. I really like this next case. And what was the next case called? Shuttlesworth. That's what it is. Shuttlesworth. Here's the Supreme Court in 1962 citing a host of state Supreme Court decisions about. So if I incited somebody else to make a citizen's arrest, which is legal, by creating in their minds reasonable suspicion that a felony had been committed, to incite them to arrest the felon because I happen to know they're the kind that would arrest the felon. And so here I have Shuttlesworth from the Supreme Court, 1962, 373 U.S., 262. Shuttlesworth versus City of Birmingham. And look at that quote from the Supreme Court with all those state Supreme Court cases in it, saying that it is generally recognized there can be no conviction for aiding and abetting someone to do an innocent act. So if I cause somebody to make a citizen's arrest by proving to them a felony had been committed, or creating reasonable suspicion in their minds, they have a state law that says they can arrest a felon. So I fit right into this Supreme Court case where it's generally recognized there can be no conviction if I aid and abet or incite somebody to do an innocent act. So, saying, and where I'm going with this is the Citizens Review Panel. I've assembled some people to look at proof that you're a felon, and we're going to hold a hearing. If you got any evidence that you're not a felon, like it says in this criminal complaint that our citizens committee is going to look at, you want to bring that evidence to the hearing. Because I'm talking to them to cause them to arrest you. If they find out you're a felon, they'll arrest you, because this law says they can. Hear how legal that is? And you'll find that anybody that raises their head, if you haven't found out already, here in America, if you stand up for your rights, they'll cut your head off for doing it. It's just America. And that word threat, I heard a couple people today on talk radio use it very loosely. They don't have an education in law. They don't know enough about the law to know the gravity of an appellate decision when it comes to interpreting the law. And so ignorance of the law becomes very dangerous. And I'm doing a workup on the word threat. True threat. And I think it was Sutcliffe that says only true threats can be punished. Let me do a search for that. Find Sutcliffe. Okay, find it again, please. There's a very specific quote from Sutcliffe that I wanted to give you. And I think this is the end. Yeah, here it is. My comment was only true threats are punished under these statutes. It has to be a true threat. A first-person threat to commit an act of unlawful violence against the person of another in interstate commerce, like on the phone or in the mail or email. And there's the quote from Sutcliffe, Ninth Circuit, 505 Federal 3rd, 944. 505 Federal 3rd, 944. A conviction under 875C, that's another statute. That's threatening anybody instead of threatening the president like we saw under 879A3. A conviction under 875C requires the specific intent to threaten, and only true threats may be prohibited. and it's citing Virginia versus Black. It was a free speech decision about cross burning. So only true threats may be punished. And I think it was a 10th Circuit case, Wheeler, where the 10th Circuit said even incitement is a threat. Because this guy had told his ex-wife, I think it was, I'm going to get my... he was a preacher of some sort. I'm going to get my followers to do whatever. Violence. And they found him guilty. So you have to do the work on your own circuit. I'm doing all this for my circuit on the 9th Circuit, West Coast. Quick question, JL says, are you going to keep doing these Monday talk shows in the month of June? Really enjoy these. Well, thank you. I can't think of a whole lot of things to say on these calls that I haven't given you free in tutorials on YouTube and on my webpage. It's everything you need to really become a terror. And if you concentrate on identifying crimes on the part of public servants, you read your criminal code in your state like it's obvious I've read mine, and do companion work or an analogous exploration of your own state's law, you can become a different person to the government. They just would rather not have you in court because you might get the prosecutor disbarred. You might get the judge kicked off the bench. Local student, he rocks. He settled with the city a few weeks ago. They repaid his, they compensated him his impound fees because they wrongfully seized his car that was parked on the street. And the attorney that met him to give him a check says, "Hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm from the city. I'm here to settle." Nobody writes like this. Nobody writes like, "Hey, amen. Don't forget that feeling." What he meant to say was, I just got my ass kicked by a pro se self-taught guy. Where was I going with this? Oh, you'll become somebody different to them when they see paperwork of this caliber, this quality, written so meticulously that you get from my courses. Okay, write this down. It's done downloading. wevgov.com/cases.zip. Cases.zip. It's a database of Supreme Court cases in PDF. wevgov.com/cases.zip. All lowercase, no spaces. That is today's freebie. One of them. So you want to know what a threat is and is not, in case you have to keep your car from being impounded, if you have to keep the dog catcher off of your property when they walk onto your property to wake up your deaf dog so they can take them. They did it to me here in Washington. They got no business on private property. So, anyway... So I'm doing a workup on what is and is not a threat, because these morons in the press are dangerous, the way they throw that word around. You see, the very strict threshold I have to meet has to be a first-person context, has to be a direct threat of unlawful violence, not just a hint. And then you watch TV again, you listen to radio again. And the people that use that word threat, you'll have a whole different take on just how dangerous that word is when you see how loosely it's used. When in fact, it's a very strict standard that you have to meet to be guilty under those statutes. So, things you gotta know. when you know what direction the government's gonna be coming from, you can steer clear, you know? Just to, you know, see what you can do to keep out from underneath the wheels of the government. And it's very important to know probable cause. There has to be probable cause of each element of the offense. I'm going to paste a large annotation into the chat. There's two cases. The second one is Supreme Court, May of 2016, Torres versus Lynch. The first one of the two I just pasted is Ninth Circuit, 1994, Gasho versus U.S. It is fundamental that a person is not criminally responsible unless criminal intent accompanies the wrongful act. Consequently, to have probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, an arresting officer would have to reasonably believe that Sharon Gasho intended to defy or frustrate the seizure of a ship at the time that she removed the logbooks. She just removed the logbooks. She wasn't trying to frustrate anything. She didn't have criminal intent, and she would have had to have it. Thank you. And the second quote, considering the law respecting mens rea, or criminal intent, in general, courts interpret criminal statutes to require that a defendant possess a mens rea, or a guilty mind, as to every element of the offense. Each element. You have to have a guilty mind regarding each element. That 879, or no, the 875 that we just looked at says if somebody in interstate commerce conveys a threat. So if I'm out on my lawn and I tell my neighbor, I'm going to break your legs. That's not interstate commerce, is it? But if it's over email, what do you mean email? I emailed my neighbor that I was going to break his legs. How am I to know I'm in interstate commerce? How many people know that the point of law called interstate commerce governs the telephone, the mail that's going next door to your house? So maybe that element, criminal intent, is not manifest in relation to interstate commerce. But you better know it, because you won't get any slack from the government. That is so even when the statute by its terms does not contain any demand of that kind, that criminal intent be manifest. It is so even if the statute doesn't contain a reference to intent. In such cases, courts read the statute against a background rule that the defendant must know each fact making his conduct illegal, or otherwise said, they infer, absent an express indication to the contrary, that Congress intended such a mental state requirement. There. This is why they can't indict Hillary under 18 U.S.C. 793. The Espionage Act. Because even though it says if somebody negligently handles secret information, secret documents, it requires criminal intent, even though it says negligence. And so hosts like Sean Hannity are calling for an indictment. It doesn't require intent, everybody. She could be just negligent. And James Comey said all that when he did his report on the investigation, says she was grossly negligent. And so go do it. No, she has to be criminally intentional, regardless of what that law says. So, let's see. So, criminal intent and the threat, every element of the offense, they have to have probable cause for each element, because if you didn't do one element of those four elements in a criminal statute, you're innocent. And so they have to have probable cause for each element. And you'll run into this time and time again. The cops will just say, oh, we're going to leave that up to the courts. Well, everybody's guilty in court. It's America. Haven't you ever been to court before, stupid? I mean, officer? No, we're going to leave it up to the court. It's so easy to be a cop when that's all you have to think. Couldn't do a probable cause assessment on a criminal statute if they had 4 years of law school. So, again, it goes back to this. There are potholes everywhere out there. And you could accidentally be thrown right into one. With the word threat, very important to know. And 830 has a question. You are unmuted, I think, aren't you? Let's see here. You're unmuted. 830. Hi, I can hear you.
David?
Yes.
David?
Yes.
Hello. My name's Paul. I'm a first-time listener to your show. Just first came out in the area last week. Came from Caesar 1, 2, and the 7 videos. What I was looking at, I'm having some ongoing problems. But I was, I'd like to have a, some kind of contact phone number so I could call your office. There's no phone numbers at all.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Email Chris Chapman. His email address is AmericanLiberties.LLC@gmail. AmericanLiberties.LLC@gmail.com. Email him. He'll forward it to me. Include your phone number in there, okay?
There's no phone number that I could just call him.
I'm not gonna do it while I'm on the web. I'm recording this call, so. AmericanLiberties.LLC@gmail. And thanks for your support. And when you've gotten into those courses, I'd appreciate a testimonial if you care to give one. What state are you in?
New York.
Okay. Does it concern taxes? Okay, if you go to wevgov.com, go to my state income taxation page and scroll down to the New York statute. It's like, 605 through 610 of your... Okay,
yeah, right,
yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah, right now it's with the feds right now.
Okay, just go through that channel then and we'll get together in a couple days. Okay, Paul, my pleasure, and thanks again for your support. So, there are potholes everywhere. You want to know where they are. I've got a brain full of what the government does, so I can see them coming. And I know what to, most times, what to stay away from. So, I want everybody to stay out of jail. And then you work on the next one. Keep your wallet closed. That's the tough one, man. They got ways of getting your money where you just say, you know, where's the jury when you need them? So just be safe out there. And this use of the term threat on the air, as I've heard these hosts use it, man, it opens up a hole right in front of you. And if you're not careful, you can fall right into it. And the government doesn't care. Once they get the criminal complaint filed, once they get the indictment, all bets are off. You lose. Because the law doesn't count for crap in America. And again, I'm doing this work for the Ninth Circuit to see where it lies on this definition. And it might be different on your circuit. So stand by and I'll have a briefing of this probably in another week. Till then, none of this is legal advice. My name is David Merlin. Thanks so much for tuning in to No Confidence tonight, and I'll see you on the next episode.